So welcome to Post Carbon Radio. This is Bing Gong, your host. My regular co-host, Kara Nyhos, had an emergency at work, so she won't be with us today. In the first half hour, we were going to be covering the patterning instinct, a cultural history of humanity's search for meaning, written by Jeremy Lent, who's in the studio this morning. Welcome to Post Carbon Radio, Jeremy. So let's start with Jeremy. What is the patterning instinct? Why is it important?
Sure, Bing. What the patterning instinct is, it's this instinct that humans actually have that kind of makes them unique, different from any other animals, in the sense that it's the instinct we have to just make meaning, make patterns out of everything we see in the world around us. And at the core of it, it's the instinct that's given us civilization, that's caused us to develop cultures and everything we have around us. But it's also this instinct that has driven some of the imbalances we have with the natural world that we are looking at today, too.
Well, tell us some of the research that you've done into different cultures and the mindsets that led up to the mindset we have today and the crisis of insustainability that we have today.
Yeah, sure, Bing. So, in fact, this book's kind of the result of about a 10-year research program of my own, if you will. And I started it not even thinking I was going to necessarily turn it into a book. I really went through my own search for meaning, if you will. And I was trying to kind of peel the onion of all these different things, values, assumptions that we take for granted and understand where they came from. And as I began to go sort of deeper and deeper, I realized it kept going back further in time to sort of early Western civilization. Then I realized other civilizations totally made different meanings out of the universe. And where did that come from? Went back to the beginnings of agriculture and ultimately the beginnings of what made us human. And the amazing thing was realizing how these layers of values that we have, sort of watching how they led to the civilization we have today, really began to sort of transform my understanding of things. I realized we needed to sort of have a book that would help us to see how these layers bring us to our current civilization.
Well, you talk about root metaphors and that shape how we view and act in the world. What is a root metaphor, and what are the root metaphors operating today, and what impact do they have?
Yeah, that's something I discovered as I started to do this research, is that when we sort of make sense of things using this patterning instinct, a lot of the time we're actually using metaphors for our sort of core embodied way of being. That it turns out that virtually all abstract ideas sort of come up from a scaffolding of just sort of our day-to-day living. So, for example, things like high is good and low is bad, or warm feels good or cold. And these sort of form the structures of everything the sort of sense we make of things. So with this patterning instinct, it turns out that different cultures use metaphors to make sense out of the whole natural world and humans' relationship with it. So, for example, like hunter-gatherers actually saw nature in their mind as a giving parent. In modern times, we see nature more like a sort of resource to be exploited or more like a machine. But the things about root metaphors is that we get so used to them that we stop thinking of them as metaphors. It's like they hide in plain sight, and then we just talk about them as though that is real rather than actually something we've constructed.
Right, like most indigenous people see the earth as a mother.
Right, that's right, and they see the earth as a mother and the heavens as a father. It's interesting how you get that same sort of polarity among many indigenous cultures. And you see that in real extreme situations when Europeans, for example, first came to the New World, as they thought of it as, and they were trying to impose things like agriculture and then industry and mining, and the indigenous people going, how can you do that? It's like it's sort of digging into the earth is like digging into the bones of our mother. Like it's just totally, unthinkable, basically. And that gives you a sense of how those root metaphors can be so different.
Right. We see that in them wanting to keep the oil in the ground.
Right.
So your central claim is that our prevailing worldview is inherited from previous generations and has a direct impact on our day-to-day world. Let's look at a present-day challenge that, like climate change. How is this linked to ideas from the past, and why does this linkage matter now?
Yeah, well, with climate change, in a way, to try to understand that, it helps to sort of look at it in two sort of different questions. One is, how did we get to this problem of climate change in the first place? And then, how is it so difficult for us to fix it? And if we look first at just how we got to this problem, the interesting thing about it is that really the way we came to it is very similar to the way in which lots of cultures throughout history have found an imbalance with nature. So something that's fascinating that most people don't realize is that even way back when our ancestors were hunter-gatherers, once they developed the ability to use weapons, they had an imbalance with nature. So the first humans that came to North or South America or Australia caused massive extinctions. And they didn't realize they were doing it. They were just doing it because things seemed pretty easy. Like, these animals didn't have fear of them. They could kill them. Great. And it took thousands of years for these extinctions to happen. So similarly with climate change, when in the 19th century we began to use fossil fuels and change the chemistry of the atmosphere, we didn't know we were doing it, but we started to cause a new imbalance. The big difference is that for the last 25 years, we know that we're doing it. And then the issue gets to be, well, how can we not, once we realize this thing, how can we not solve that? And that has to do with a lot of the underlying values that this global civilization has that we're in, that are causing further and further imbalance with the natural world, and the actual underlying values of the drivers are causing that. And without changing some of those underlying values, we're not going to change. We're not going to really solve the problem.
Well, I think we can go back to the scientific revolution, right? You want to talk a little bit about that and how that's influenced our thinking?
Yes, the scientific revolution was one of the most important kind of transformation points in the different ways in which humans have really seen the natural world. There, really there, around the 17th century, we see a couple of brand new ways of understanding nature that really excited people back then. So one idea was Francis Bacon, as this kind of prophet of the scientific revolution, talked about this notion of conquering nature. And back then, that seemed like a fabulous new way of looking at things compared to a traditional Christian view, say, of how humans should be with the natural world. And then what got really exciting to the scientists at the time was seeing nature like this complex machine. In those days, like the clock was the sort of core metaphor. It was like, wow, nature is just like a clock. If we can take these little bits, go down to that tiniest bit, we can understand it better. So for hundreds of years, science grew based on these metaphors. The amazing thing is that, again, people lost sight of them being metaphors. So that now, most people, you just open any kind of newspaper or whatever, you'll read about genes that code, and you read about, like, the hardware of the wiring of the brain and all this kind of stuff, as though we assume that nature actually is a machine. And that is a very dangerous sort of underlying assumption that drives a lot of our unsustainability.
Yeah, it's inanimate, and
right. And of course, if it's inanimate and it has no sacredness, well, it's just a resource to exploit. And so, you know, and so if something goes wrong with it, then fix it just like you'd fix a computer. So even so, that extends even to climate change. So now you have people talking about the notion, for example, of geoengineering as a solution. Like, okay, well, we've got nature's out of whack. You know, no problem. It's an engineering problem like everything else. If we apply enough of our insights to it, we can fix that too. But I think that's wildly mistaken.
Yes, with all its unintended consequences.
Exactly.
Well, the scientific consensus is clear that climate change is driving us toward a global crisis. You argue in the Patterning Instinct that even if we succeeded in dealing with climate change without a major shift in our thinking, it would only be replaced by another existential threat. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I think this is something that sometimes people lose sight of when when we're looking at trying to solve climate change, that there are proposed solutions to climate change as an issue, which actually have the potential to be moderately successful, at least, if they are endorsed like worldwide. So one example is something that we all know about is massive investment in renewables. And that's oftentimes like a positive light when we're talking about climate change as to how renewables are becoming more and more widespread. Another example, and it's a great idea, it's a great policy, is to have a significant tax on carbon. And if that were applied worldwide, it would shift behaviors. And you could imagine a scenario where those things, if they were endorsed widely enough, could begin to shift the needle on climate change itself. But the problem, in fact, one of the reasons I think those kinds of solutions will probably become more accepted in the next few years is that they don't deal with the underlying problem of global capitalism and this underlying sense of nature as a resource to exploit. So it's as though those solutions can be really taken up by the neoliberal global capitalist system because they can say, great, we can fix those. We're back onto a sustainable path of climate change. We can keep exploiting the earth and keep getting the billionaires wealthier. And, yeah, phew, we solved that one. But there's these other all that really does is just buy time till the next crises, which can be even greater. And they can be anything like the water is going to become a major, major issue in the 21st century. You've got things like deforestation, desertification, the sixth extinction of species, and you have these monocropping. So basically, the natural world is being devastated as humans get to exploit it increasingly over the decades.
Right. And I was thinking that let's go here. While we face crises that require immediate action, do we really have time to shift our worldview on a global scale? Shouldn't we focus on action?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And the answer is we have to do both. There's no way that we can just kind of focus on things like shifting worldviews and let these crises get out of control the way they are right now. But not to deal with the underlying sources just allows these problems to get worse and worse. Like, imagine, for example, like a factory that is polluting a river. And if you're in a town living downstream from the river, you go, oh, wow, we've got to fix this solution. We're getting poisoned. So you, like, create all these plans to sterilize the water, do all this stuff. But the problems just get worse and worse. So at some point, you have to go upstream and say, we got to do something about this factory. And that's essentially what's going on. We can fix the problems as they get worse and worse, but without actually looking at this underlying worldview that we have that's causing it, then we're just basically on a kind of a losing battle.
That brings to mind Einstein's quote that you hear often, that we can't solve the problem with the thinking that got us into it.
Right, and that is so true, and that's exactly what we're doing a lot of the time right now.
Yeah. Well, you go back and look at traditional China as a rich source of ideas that can help inform a new worldview. Yet, as you point out, China has hardly been free from human-made catastrophes throughout history. What specific ideas do you think we should take from Eastern thought? And why didn't these ideas save China from their own problems?
Yeah, there's a lot of rich issues there, Bing. And in fact, one of the big themes of my book, The Patterning Instinct, is how if you look in early times, early agricultural civilizations around the world, they had kind of similar underlying ways of looking at the natural world. And then you saw this big shift between European thinking about 2,500 years ago with the ancient Greeks and Chinese thinking. And really two fundamentally different worldviews arose. So in the West, we got this sense of humans as being separate from nature, which led to all these issues we're talking about right now. In China, there was a different sense, a sense of humans being harmonized with nature, humans being an integral part of the natural world. And really the whole the whole sort of sense of what it means to be human is to find a way to harmonize. Whereas in the West, it was like, how do you find a way to conquer nature, to exploit it? So there's a lot we can learn from the way that the Chinese essentially saw meaning arising, because they saw meaning as actually embedded in the natural world, in what they call the Tao, rather than from in some sort of transcendent place, like some sort of God up there in the heavens. And that's where we can learn a lot from China. But then it does get to your other point. So if the Chinese had this way of focusing on harmonizing, well, how did they? What caused them to come up with their own environmental problems? And the reality is that if you look at the history of China, they had massive environmental challenges themselves. When they cut down so many trees to build the Great Wall, that they caused this amazing sedimentation, the Yellow River, which had, I think, something like 2/3 of the population got flooded out of their towns and villages as a result of that, things like that. And I think that, again, just like when we were looking at hunter-gatherers causing extinctions around the world, what we see throughout history is humans have a way, because of the power that we can exert over the natural world, we have a way of kind of blundering into these places, even if we have good intentions, and causing these massive imbalances with nature, which is why the real right now, as we're looking at the imbalances we're causing with things like climate change and the devastation to the whole natural world right now, is for the first time we have the ability to recognize what we're doing. And that's where the traditional Chinese ideas of harmonizing can really get to be meaningful for us now if we look at ways in which they can be integrated with our modern scientific understanding. And I believe there are ways that they can be.
Yes, I'm resonate a lot with Taoism and natural ways of being, and a student of Tai Chi Chuan, where you don't resist, you go with the flow and
right,
so forth.
Exactly. And you know, we can apply those ways of being with that energy force within ourselves, apply the same principles to how we relate to nature, too.
Right. Yeah. Well, if you could offer a worldview for a healthy, just, and sustainable future society, what elements would it include?
I think fundamentally it would come from a recognition of our connectedness, that really our so many of the problems we're facing in our world right now come from a civilization and a cultural set of assumptions that focus on separateness, humans separate from nature, beliefs about selfish individuals being separate from community, things that are basically myths that have grown up in the West. And I think an alternative worldview that could really get us to a more sustainable place would recognize the intrinsic connectivity of everything around us, and our connectedness as humans with other humans, the connectedness of humans with all of nature, and the recognition that really we are part of this amazing and complex system that is nature, and that we're not separate from it, and that we're not trying to conquer it, but what we can do is use what is unique about our patterning instinct, what makes us different, use that as a way to harmonize with nature in the optimal way. And I think that's doable. And that's doable not just by looking back to ancient wisdom traditions, which in themselves are a rich source of meaning, but also by applying modern scientific insights. Because one of the most interesting things that I thought I came to as I researched this book and I put into this book is recognizing that a lot of modern systems understanding about life, such as systems biology, complexity science, a lot of these ways of scientific insights into how things connect actually have a lot to do with these traditional Chinese and indigenous ways of understanding the world. So it's not a matter of just looking back, but it's a matter of using traditional wisdom and modern insights to create a more integrated worldview.
Well, I see you're going to be in conversation with Paul Ehrlich sometime, I think, next month. And
that's right.
Here's a quote from Paul Ehrlich. The book is a tour de force on the biological and psychological background of the human predicament. If you are concerned about our future, and you should know about our past. This amazing, well-documented book should be read by every college student and every congressman. That's a pretty good testimonial, let's say. Here's something that Karin, my co-host, she kind of read some of the highlights of your email. And she said that a dialectical materialist would say that there is no reshaping of the mind of an individual or certainty of the collective worldview of a whole society without interlocking changes in the material infrastructure of the society. She would be interested to hear your response to this.
I think that is a great insight, mm-hmm. and I couldn't agree more. And because it's not like we form our worldviews separate from the world in which we live. And in fact, something that is so interesting about the patterning instinct itself is we, as infants, we try to use this instinct to make sense, to learn a language and to make sense of everything around us. And the way that our culture has structured the world around us actually literally sculpts the neural organization of our brains in order to help us to make sense of life. And so we then become a part of our culture. So in a way, that is really a lot of what the book's about, is how culture actually shapes the values of a civilization and how those values actually shape history. So we can't look at a sense of meaning-making separate from the physical world in which we're embedded. I think that's so true.
And then she says, I'm glad you include patriarchy in your critique because, indeed, in Western intellectual history, nature is construed as female, and the domination and control of nature is closely linked to the domination and control of women. And she quotes Francis Bacon, like you did
right.
here, is a perfect example of this.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I go into that a little bit in the book about how he actually was involved in some of the trials they were doing at the time of witches. So you had these witches of a place called Pendle Hill who ended up on the gallows right around the time that he came into power. So a lot of this metaphor of conquering nature has to do with, like, we're going to put her on the rack. And there's all these kind of sexual innuendos in the way he talks about it, which is quite disturbing.
Well, is there a website you'd like to mention, Jeremy?
Yeah, but sure. If you go to my own author website, it's just Jeremy Lent, JEREMYLENT.com. Then you can read all about the patterning instinct there. And mm-hmm. it actually comes on sale tomorrow. So it's an exciting time for me. Mm-hmm. This is the week it's coming out.
Great. Do you want to mention some of these launch events that are coming up?
Oh, sure. Thank you, Bing. Yeah, I'd be happy to. So, yeah, on this Thursday at Books, Inc. in Berkeley, I'm going to be in conversation with Fritjof Capra, the world-leading systems thinker who inspired me a lot and who wrote the foreword for this book. And so that's going to be at 7 p.m. on Thursday, May 25th. And then, Bing, you mentioned before, I'll be in conversation with Paul Ehrlich at Kepler's in Menlo Park on Wednesday, June 7th at 7:30. We'll be talking about the future is what we make of it, but what will that be? And then finally, there are a couple other things, but the one that we have here is at Corte Madera at Book Passage on Saturday, June 17th at 7 p.m. I'll be there doing some reading from the book and signing copies. And so people here in Marin might be able to make that one more easily.
And maybe you could come to Point Reyes Station. We have a very good bookstore here that would probably love to.
That would be wonderful.
Book reading.
Let's follow up on that. I would love that opportunity.
Well, thank you very much, Jerry, for joining us today on Post Carbon, and good luck with your book. It's going to be a tour de force.
Thank you so much, Bing. It's been great being here with you. Thank you.